From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, some personal stories illustrate the issue of black male incarceration in Milwaukee. Later, challenger Rob Zerbon says he believes Paul Ryan is vulnerable in the 1st District.
His, economic policies, the economists have shot holes in it, and this is widely perceived as one of his strengths, and I think it's his biggest weakness.
Harry Potter as Allen Ginsberg, a review of Daniel Radcliffe's latest acting role. And violinist Heather Braun returns to Milwaukee with high hopes for the next generation.
I don't think that people wanting to become classical musicians will ever go away because it is such an amazing feeling. And the music that we prepare, it's such amazing music to play and to perform.
Lake Effect is next after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today. This week, WUWM, along with Milwaukee Public Television, launched a 6-month exploration of why Wisconsin imprisons more black men than any other state. In many cases, the men who are incarcerated are repeat offenders. According to a 2012 study, nearly a third of those released from prison end up behind bars again after just 3 years. WUWM's Latoya Dennis caught up with a young man working with a group called Project Return to get his life on track and also hit the streets in one of the worst zip codes in Milwaukee when it comes to the number of black men in prison from the area. The goal was to find out about life after prison, the challenges ex-offenders face, and why some people reoffend.
My first and last name's Larry Jackson.
All right, Larry, how old are you?
57. But I've been doing time since I was a child.
How old were you in your first prison stint?
9 years old.
So you went to a juvenile facility at 9?
As a juvenile.
What'd you do?
Just totally uncontrollable, running the streets, acting stupid.
Why?
That beats me. If I knew, I wouldn't have been doing it.
Well, you may know now, though.
I've always been a hustler all my life. I'd go clean people's garages, clean their basements out, rake their grass, cut their grass, all kinds of things to make money. I used to go to grocery stores and carry women's groceries out to the car for them and put them in the car for them and stuff like that. For me to go out there and eventually turn to crime, it was just knowing too much, being out there too much, getting caught up with the wrong people, I'd like to think,
So how many times have you either been in a juvenile facility or jail or prison? Any idea?
I couldn't begin to tell you.
How much time would you say you've spent there?
Probably around a good 20 years of my life.
How long was your last time?
I got out in 03.
And haven't been back?
No.
That's a long time.
For me? Shoot, I'd be lucky to stay out a year when I get out.
What changed?
Me? I finally made up my mind that I'm not going back. I'm not going back.
And why did you make that decision, though, when so many people continue with that cycle?
I just said that this ain't for me. I've given them enough of my life, and I've done that. I've given them enough of my life. I've wasted enough of my life, And I'm no dumb man by a long shot. I got a college education. I have an associate's degree. I have an automotive servicing degree from MATC. You know what I'm saying? I got education I have.
Were these degrees that you got while in prison?
While incarcerated. Yeah. While incarcerated. I didn't just waste the time. The time wasn't totally wasted. I got my GED in jail. I went to college behind walls at UWGB. I took up lithography. I'm a printer by trade. I can run 7 presses, maintenance every press I run. But I couldn't find a job out here with what I learned in jail. As soon as they look at my prison record or my record, they turn me around. I was fortunate enough to know what I know, where I can get out here and do things. I make more money from word of mouth from working for people because I do good work, and I'm dependable.
So the problem was when you got out, you couldn't find a job.
You can't do nothing when you get out.
Did you want a job?
Yes, I've been all over the place looking for jobs. If I don't go through a temp service making $6-7 an hour, I can't work. You can't go to a factory no more and say, can I fill out an application and tell them your skills and get paid for what you know? They don't do that no more.
And what about the services that are there to help people find jobs when they get out of prison or to help people make that transition?
I have yet to see them. I have seen none of them. Even these pre-release centers they got out here, the pre-release centers, you know, they got people, they got work release coordinators at these pre-release centers. You know what I'm saying? If you get a job, it ain't going to be about nothing. It ain't going to be about nothing. It's going to be, what, $6, $7, $8 an hour? How you going to live off that? You know, I'm blessed that I know what I know, and I can get out here and make my money out here in these streets. I'm not saying that to earn any jobs here. As a matter of fact, I went to the Fatherhood Summit for license recovery, driver's license recovery.
Do you have a license?
No, I do not. You know.
You're driving.
Yes. Yes, I am. You know. And how else are you going to make your money? You can't make no money. It's a chance you got to take. It's a chance you got to take. How am I going to move my tools? How can I get from one job to another?
So let me ask you this. Why don't you have a driver's license?
I lost my license in 83, and I kept driving, and I've been caught operating after suspension. And every time I get caught, here goes some more time. The extension gets longer and longer and longer. You know what I'm saying? The suspensions and revocations just keep getting longer and longer and longer. And now I'm going back. I go back to court again for operating after revocation next month. I am eligible to get my license. But now at 50, I caught a OWI. That's been hanging over me for 7 years now. So he told me I got to go to Impact. I paid it once. They said I didn't satisfy the program. So now I got to pay another $265 to Impact. Then I got to turn around and pay a reinstatement fee. Then I got to take the written and the road test.
So what happens, though, if you get stopped again and you get another ticket and you don't have a license?
That's a chance you got to take to get this money. That's a chance I have to take. You know, it's just out here like that. You know, it's just a chance I have to take right now because the money isn't that great that I can just go drop $500, $600 to get my license back. You know what I'm saying? And on top of that, I got about $1,000 worth of tickets that need to be paid. You know what I'm saying? There's no help out there for that.
Tell me your first and last name.
Robert Boston.
And Robert, how old are you?
44.
You just got out of prison?
Yeah, from doing 14 and a half years.
Why? Why were you there?
Gun case.
Now, was this your first time in prison?
No, it was my fifth time.
Okay. So how much time, how many years would you say that you spent there?
All together? Mm-hmm. Ooh, about 20.
What are you doing now?
Well, I was just working, but then, you know, I got sick and they fired me. Why, I don't know. And now I'm back out here looking for a job.
What type of work were you doing?
Carpentry, drywall, and electrician, and all that type of stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to find a job?
I got out December. I got my job. I started June. Okay. About 6 months.
At what age did you first go to prison?
Ooh, 19, 20.
Yeah. And what was that for?
Possession of a controlled substance.
Why do you think you went down the path that you did?
My environment. Hey, what's up, man? You next, come on. Huh? Yeah, it used to be real rough over here. It didn't mellowed out. It used to be a bad neighborhood over here.
You grew up over here?
Yeah, I've been over here since 74.
Where did you live?
Right around the corner around here on 8th and Ring, between 8th and 9th and Ring.
Still there?
I mean Concordia. No, our house been tore down. I done moved, but I just come back every day.
Did you graduate high school?
No, I got a GED. Got that, yeah, while I was locked up.
What made you get out this time and say, hey, this is going to be different? I'm not going back.
I'm tired of doing time. I'm trying to stay out. You know, I got grandbabies and stuff now. My daughters and had kids and stuff, you know.
So you're looking for a job now. What type of work are you looking for?
Basically the same thing or food service. I got a food service certificate while I was locked up.
Do you think there's enough help out there for guys like you, guys who get out and say, hey, I want to do the right thing?
It all depends on where you go. Certain places help you, certain places don't give you no help at all.
So what are the places that helped you?
Since I've been out, workforce down here on Capitol and Richards. And I got hired through the temp service for about 2 weeks. I worked through the temp service before I got my job when I first got out.
So what do you think you need? What sort of help do you need getting a job?
Basically, no, I can go get me a job tomorrow if I really wanted one.
So why haven't you done that?
I'm just acting lazy right now. I can go get hired in the food service industry because I cook. Yeah.
So you say you're being lazy. Why is that?
I don't know, because I worked all summer, and then, like I told you, I got sick for a couple of days, got my doctor's excuse saying why I was sick, and they fired me, so I'm feeling some kind of way right now.
So how do you get money? How do you pay your bills?
Oh, I don't hustle. If that's
what
you
know. Oh, no, that's not what I'm asking you. My question is for real. No, it's not insinuating, hey, you do this. It's a real question.
How do I pay bills?
Yeah, how do you?
Well, no, I don't. I live with somebody.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when do you think you're going to go get that job then?
Probably next month.
You're going to wait that long? Why?
I'm just having me a little vacation time. You know, I just did 14 and a half years, so I'm almost, you know, chill out a little bit, then I'm going to go back to work.
I am just going to start by having you tell me your first and your last name.
Deontay Tate, 22.
How many times have you been to prison?
Once. 2.5 years.
Why did you go?
Armed robbery.
How old were you when you committed that robbery?
I was 18.
Why'd you do it?
Things were going pretty bad for me at that time, and I had to survive.
And when you say things are going pretty bad, talk to me a little bit about what you mean.
Well, first and foremost, my auntie had just died. You know, that took a lot out of me. I was really close with my auntie. You know, we were very close. I was extremely close with her daughter. And I guess when she died, part of me went with her.
When you say you did it to survive, what do you mean?
Basically, financial issues, stuff like that.
When you got out, what'd you do?
I was referred to an organization by the name of Project Return from my pastor at church, which is on 18th and Locust. She told me to come down here and see them.
Have you been able to find a job through them?
Actually, yes. When I was released in 2012, I started working for a company called MCSC, which is Milwaukee Community Service Corps, landscaping, stuff like that, construction, you know, pretty much, I took care of Hillside Apartments, basically.
But you no longer work for them?
No, I don't.
Why is that?
I was incarcerated again.
Why?
A couple dirty UAs, you know, stuff like that.
What is that?
Urinalysis. I was just locked up for about 6 months.
So now what are you doing?
On the road back to employment in school. I mean, I've been accepted into UWM, and I plan on going there in January for the spring semester.
What do you want to study?
Computer simulation and gaming as my major, and for my minor, I was going into photography and film.
How'd you pick your major and your minor?
I like cameras. I like taking pictures and stuff like that, film and stuff. And my major, I'm what you could call a gamer. You know, I have damn near every system that ever came out.
What is life like when you get out of prison? What do you go back to? What do you have? How do you even, you know, began to get back in the rhythm of anything?
Got to think before what you do. So I basically, I had a game plan already before I was released, and I'm just following up on it. I'm taking step by step to reach my goal. My goal is to get a 4-year degree in computer simulation and gaming, as well as associate's degree in photography and film.
So it was your second release. I'm sure you're saying I'm not going back.
No, hell no. Never.
You sound adamant about that.
I mean, when you locked in a 10x6 cell, roughly 23 hours a day, it gets to be a little wearing.
But what's the difference between the first and the second time? I mean, what's changed with you?
The first time I had what some would call a reprobative mind. You know, I really didn't care. You know, I was going to do what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. I had a major attitude problem, which I'm always working on to make better. The second time, I'm tired. I'm tired of giving these people time out of my life.
Where do you see yourself 5 years from now?
Designing my own video games, working, being my own boss, hiring other people, giving other ex-felons jobs so that they can work and support their families.
Why is that important to you?
I mean, because upon release, we're entering into a society that's designed for us to fail.
How?
The rules. Say I have a job. I'm not able to walk around with more than $100 in my pocket when I worked hard for this money. I sweated. I worked, wear and tearing on my muscles and my body for a paycheck that I'm not allowed to walk around with. I mean, I understand the no drugs and alcohol because that's what gets certain people or most people into crimes or doing crimes or committing crimes. But as for me not being able to walk around with the money that I've earned, I think it's...
Larry Jackson and Robert Boston and Deontay Tate have all vowed never to return to prison. They spoke with Latoya Dennis as part of our Project Milwaukee series, Black Men in Prison. You'll find more on our collaboration with Milwaukee Public Television on WUWM.com/Project Milwaukee. A quick break now, but keep listening. Rob Zerban hopes to do his close race with Paul Ryan last year one better with a rematch in 2014. We'll meet him when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. As we reported earlier this month, 1st District Congressman Paul Ryan will have competition next year as he seeks election to a ninth term in Congress. He'll likely face one of two Democrats who have announced they're seeking the seat. We spoke with Amar Kalika previously. Kalika would square off in the primary against Rob Zerban of Kenosha. Zerban ran in 2012, and though he lost, the margin was the narrowest since Ryan was first elected to Congress. Rob Zerban joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
What was the epiphany you had some years ago that made you decide to go from being a small business owner to running for office?
Well, in 2008, I sold my last business and dedicated my life to public service. I started working in my community, canvassing for the Great Lakes Compact, trying to make sure we protect or do everything we can to protect the fresh water of Lake Michigan in the Great Lakes. And that led to me serving on the board of directors for the League of Conservation Voters, for a statewide organization. And people encouraged me to get more active, and which led to serving as a county board supervisor. So for me, it was really just a step, a natural progression of community service.
You ran against Paul Ryan 2 years ago. Obviously, you came up short, but the numbers were closer in that district than it has seen in a while. I think it was 12 percentage points in the end. What leads you to believe in 2014 you'd be able to close that gap?
Well, it's a good question. But if you look at the results from 2012, it was the first time Paul Ryan had ever been elected or reelected with less than 55% of the vote. We actually got him below 55%. It was the first time he'd ever lost his home community of Janesville, his home county of Rock County, and even won his home voting board by a margin of 2-1. So, you know, when you see these kind of results, you know, I think a lot of people took notice. And, you know, it was the closest congressional race in the state of Wisconsin. So moving the needle from 2010, where he was reelected with over 68% of the vote, and moving that to below 55 in 2012, when he was even on the national ticket as the vice presidential nominee. So that's a big chunk to take out of his numbers. So I think if we could achieve half of that again in 2014, then we would be able to close that gap and win this race.
Where do you see him as at his most vulnerable?
I think his biggest vulnerability is, you know, he claims to be a person who's not a Washington insider, and he's been there his whole adult life. His, you know, economic policies, the economists have shot holes in it, and this is widely perceived as one of his strengths. And I think it's his biggest weakness because the numbers just simply don't add up. You know, when you spend your entire life in D.C. either working for politicians or being one yourself, this is the kind of government you get where things don't work. So, you know, he's a political insider that's lost touch with Main Street and his district that he's supposed to represent. And people want people who are going to go there and represent their interests and work to solve problems, not create them.
Paul Ryan obviously gets a lot of free publicity in his home district by way of the national media attention paid to him. How do you counter a guy that's on the national news quite a bit but not necessarily engaging on the issues as you would necessarily want them to be framed in a local race? In other words, he's engaging as the Washington Post asks him questions or as Fox News asks him questions or as even National Public Radio asks him questions, but not necessarily the way you as his opponent would ask.
And that's the big problem for Paul is that, you know, he does have this national exposure. He is playing to a national audience, and he's forgotten where he's come from. He's forgotten about the people in the 1st Congressional District. I've spent the last 3 years traveling around the 1st District, getting to meet people, listen to what it is that they really want to see their elected representatives work on. You know, I was a small business owner. I employed 50 people. I understand what these small business owners are going through right now in these tough economic times. They understand it was expensive before we had the Affordable Care Act to get health insurance. You know, I saw my premiums going up 10, 15, as high as 18% year after year of my health insurance policy that I provided to my employees. So I've gotten a better understanding of what the people in the 1st District are being faced with right now, as opposed to Paul Ryan, who's out there, you know, advocating to the special interests who are funding his campaign for higher office, it looks like.
Well, and right now as we have this conversation, the president is mired in challenges related to the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. When you speak to people in the 1st District, first of all, what do you hear about their feelings about how health care reform is rolling out?
Well, I don't think it's any secret. I think a lot of people are unhappy and wish the rollout would have been a better thought-out process. But, you know, let's work together and make sure we're focusing on how to move forward and provide as many people with health care as possible. Let's not dwell on mistakes that were made or let's focus on what can be improved upon to make sure it's achieving its ultimate goal of getting more coverage for more people at a better price and better coverage. Let's not forget that before this law was in place, insurance companies could deny people for pre-existing conditions. There were maximum payouts that people were faced with. If you had a life-threatening illness that was very expensive, you could be forced into bankruptcy. That's no longer the case. Kids can now stay on their parents' insurance until they're the age of 26 and get established and on their own 2 feet, you know, and start their life and get up and running. So there are a lot of good things that came with this health care law. Let's not forget that. Can it be improved upon? Absolutely. And I think we should all work together to make sure that happens.
When the Affordable Care Act was coming around, there were critics, people like Paul Ryan, who said this was going to have a terrible effect on small business owners and that the result might be that they would just go ahead and cut people off of their insurance. As a former small business owner yourself, where do you see healthcare falling in the job creation and job maintenance issue?
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, having employed 50 people and I provided excellent benefits. In fact, I provided a Blue Cross Blue Shield HMO PPO executive plan insurance for my employees. It was one of my most expensive benefits, and I felt it was so important that I did the best I could. I had 90% of my employees signed up for it. I subsidized it by 70% to make sure they could all afford it. And once we, as a nation, address these healthcare costs that had been spiraling out of control during the entire Bush administration, and you saw that their answer to address the problem was to do absolutely nothing. So the Democrats and the president worked together to try and make sure that we could address these costs, which helps the business environment. Because once you contain these costs or get them under control, businesses can plan better like I was able to. So I would have welcomed the Affordable Care Act back when I was operating my companies because it would have helped me get a better handle on those expenses. So I think that this is a big bonus for the business community. In fact, I serve on the Wisconsin Business Alliance Board of Directors, another statewide organization. And we go around the state educating small businesses on the benefits of the Affordable Care Act and how it can help them. So I think this is going to help us create more jobs in Southeast Wisconsin. And we need to make sure that we have people who are working to that end as opposed to people who are just trying to obstruct progress, which, in my opinion, Paul Ryan has been doing, obstructing the ability for job creation in Southeast Wisconsin.
Is there an answer to the issue of partisan gridlock in Washington?
That's a good question. You know, I think if you look at national polling right now, with Congress's approval being at an all-time low and that of the Republican Party as well after they, you know, held the country hostage and shut down our government and, you know, Paul Ryan voted to default on our obligations and also voted to shut down the government. I think that you need to replace career politicians like Paul Ryan with people who have experience, like small business owners that I was, who know that people are relying on the government to work in a way that helps them create jobs, helps get our economy moving, as opposed to just being obstructionists, which the Republican-controlled House of Representatives has pretty much been doing.
Some have complained that it is the newer politicians that have led to a lot of the gridlock. They point to people like Ted Cruz in Texas and sort of a new breed of politicians as being less willing to compromise.
Well, and that's the problem. I think it was Congressman Barney Frank said it best when – before he retired. He said the problem with the House GOP is you're either dealing with somebody like Michelle Bachmann or you're dealing with somebody who's afraid of being primaried by somebody like Michelle Bachmann. And it's these, you know, highly gerrymandered districts that allow these hyper-partisan politicians like Michelle Bachmann, Paul Ryan, these extreme politicians who are pandering to a very small base to win their primaries, that safe gerrymandered districts have allowed them to create this narrative. I mean, if you look at organizations like Club for Growth, Americans for Prosperity, they're driving an agenda that is catering to the smallest percentage of Americans who don't want to support programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And that's why Paul Ryan writes extreme, out-of-touch budgets that call for making Medicare into a voucher program. So we need to make sure that the elected officials we're sending to Washington have an interest in working for the entire country, not just a small group of people.
Speaking of primaries, you do have a challenger for the Democratic nomination. Do the fundraising implications of running a primary campaign race and then potentially a general election campaign race, do they concern you?
You know, this is a relatively new dynamic. You know, as you know, I just announced on October 26th. So I have been focusing on my announcement and my race and, like I said, getting around the first district to talk to people to see what it is that they want to see in their representative. You know, I've been meeting with firemen, not-for-profits, churches, homeless centers, food pantries, and that's what I've been focusing on. So I hadn't really given much thought to what the dynamic of a primary might mean. In fact, I don't even know if the person you're talking about has actually announced his campaign yet. We'll just have to wait and see.
Rob Zerban, thank you so much. Best of luck.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Rob Zerban of Kenosha is running for the Democratic nomination for Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, the seat held by Republican Paul Ryan. Zerban faced Ryan in 2012. There is a link to more information on the Zerban campaign from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Incidentally, we hope to have Paul Ryan on the air in the weeks to come. Keep listening. Film contributor Dave Lurson weighs in on a big shift from Daniel Radcliffe's Harry Potter days. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. Before Allen Ginsberg was known around the world as a beat poet, even he had to find his way as a young college student. In his case, Columbia University was the place that shaped his early college days, but it may come as no surprise that the structured Ivy League experience clashed with his outspoken style. A new movie called Kill Your Darlings portrays these years, and it's the latest giant leap away from the Harry Potter franchise for actor Daniel Radcliffe, who plays Ginsberg. Lake Effect film contributor Dave Lurson talked with Dan Harmon about Kill Your Darlings. Lurson started with a review of how the actor did.
As young Allen Ginsberg in Kill Your Darlings, Daniel Radcliffe is a casting dream. Like the famous pupil he played in the Harry Potter series, Radcliffe's version of the freshman Ginsberg is earnest, bespectacled, and studious, a minority in a muggle's world thrust into an academy every bit as demanding as Hogwarts, Columbia University.
I will say that while I was watching it, I did not think about Harry Potter even once. maybe I thought about it once just to realize that I haven't been thinking about it at all.
Well, somewhere along the way, as I was watching Daniel Radcliffe and thinking about the role he was playing, Harry Potter truly came to mind. And I would find it hard to believe that the director of this film didn't think about this. I mean, it is a little bit of a silly analogy, I suppose, but I mean, I do see some definite connections, whether they were intended or not.
Have there been other movies about Allen Ginsberg, and where does this stand in the whole looking back at the beat generation?
Well, I've seen, you know, many interesting documentaries about Allen Ginsberg. There was a movie, focused, he was in there too, focused more on Kerouac, though. There was a kind of a mediocre version of On the Road that came out about a year ago, which had William Burroughs in a small part. I mean, so these characters have appeared in fictional films or films based on truth. I mean, dramatizations of their lives before. I think that of what I've seen, this is the best one. I found it to be a remarkable movie in many ways, a really good, astute recreation of the whole milieu of the 1940s intelligentsia in Manhattan and the gay subculture of New York City at that time. It gave a sense for what it was like to be at Columbia, an Ivy League university in those days. It gave off the sense of how a small group of people, whether they were conscious of themselves as being a group even at that point, could have an enormous impact on culture.
And one of the first things you see on the screen is based on a true story. Can you illuminate us who wrote this screenplay? Is it based on a book or is it actually written as a screenplay?
Well, it was written as a screenplay, but it's based on an incident that was always a mysterious footnote in the early lives of Ginsberg and his associates. Lucien Carr really did kill David Kammerer, as in the movie. He pled that he was fending off a assault from this person and got off with manslaughter. I think he served a couple of years and went on then to marry, have children. He is the father of Caleb Carr, the contemporary novelist. He worked for many years as an editor at UPI. And lived a relatively obscure life, whereas Ginsberg, Burroughs, and Kerouac went on to great fame. So the basics of the story, the basic incident is true. It happened. I don't know if letters, diaries, recent archival things have surfaced that allowed the screenwriter to fill in the blanks a little bit more clearly than what was known in the past about this.
And just to set the stage, this really only is a look at the college days and that incident. So I just found it interesting that they would focus so much on a part of their lives that I don't really read or see or watch movies. I don't see that much about the college days.
It all started there, though. They really did meet at Columbia University. They were all, in some ways, disgruntled students there, not fitting in particularly into the system of that time. And they went off together and separately and together again at different points and became the foundation stones of the whole beat movement, which then in turn influenced the 1960s counterculture. And people are still reading the work of Ginsberg, Kerouac, and Burroughs today. I mean, they remain important.
How do you feel the movie stands up historically? Do you think that anything there from what you know about the beats doesn't really hold water? Did they take any liberties?
Well, I mean, in filling in the conversations between them, but I mean, some of the dialogue referenced statements that the principal characters did make later on in life. So maybe backdating them to that period at Columbia is a little bit of an artistic license stroke of that. But the characters, to my mind, were all very true to life as I understand what they were, who they were at that time. So I think it did a good job. I mean, may very well be Kerouac scholars or Ginsberg scholars who spent their lives poring over all of this who might raise an objection to one thing or another. But I think as a general version of what happened, it's quite accurate.
What do you think about Radcliffe's acting ability? Forgot it was him, really. After a while, I just didn't even think about it.
Well, I guess I kept seeing Harry Potter up there a little bit. But no, I mean, he's definitely, even before the Harry Potter series ended, he was determined not to get pegged as a whimsical child actor of some sort. And he's been taking on different roles on stage and on screen. And his movie roles, many of them at this point outside of Harry Potter, have been in smaller scale projects like this, which I think is very smart. He doesn't want to be a failed you know, child actor of the first decade of the 21st century. I think he wants to build a long-lasting career as a serious actor, and he's taking good steps. This movie is another step in that direction for him.
With that kind of, I guess, notoriety will come criticism. I've read a few articles that aren't really so flattering about his portrayal of Ginsberg, that he either seems too young, he seems too innocent, he seems too whatever, I don't know, but how is he handling that criticism? Do you think it's worthy criticism?
I think that Ginsberg was young in 1943.
Okay.
obviously. I think that the portrayal of the Ginsberg family out of which he came is historically accurate. He's too innocent. I imagine that getting out of New Jersey and going to Columbia University really began a life of self-discovery for Ginsberg. So I don't think he was an extremely experienced person sexually or as a writer or socially before that time. So I don't have a problem with that. Yeah, Ginsberg did not have a beard. His trademark beard came years later. So, you know, did he look like Ginsberg at that time? Well, I don't know. Not a perfect impression, perhaps, but I don't think that's really the most important point.
All right. Well, I guess I'm getting at a few writers have suggested that he was miscast. You know, he was cast because he's Daniel Radcliffe, but he may not have been the best choice to portray Ginsberg.
Well,
it didn't fit to them.
Well, I don't know. I guess I disagree about that. I mean, certainly, you know, having Daniel Radcliffe in the movie is good from a commercial standpoint. It will draw some people to this film who might not otherwise come. So you always have these kinds of considerations in casting a film. But no, I think that young Radcliffe did a fine job as young Allen Ginsberg.
All right. Thank you for coming in, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave Larson is arts and entertainment editor for the Shepherd Express Weekly and our regular film contributor. He talked with Dan Harmon about the new movie Kill Your Darlings, which is just opening in Milwaukee. One last break and then a homecoming for a professional violinist who spent her formative years in Milwaukee. We'll meet Heather Braun when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. We've all seen the videos of tiny kids playing violins so beautifully it belies their age. Often they're students who have been schooled in their instrument through what's known as the Suzuki method, which treats learning music like learning a language. One of this area's most successful Suzuki schools is marking its 20th anniversary this week with a homecoming concert by one of its most successful graduates. Heather Braun grew up in Wauwatosa and went through the Barcel Suzuki String Academy. She's now co-concertmaster and soloist with the Orchestra of Emmanuel Music in Boston. And before her concert tomorrow at Wisconsin Lutheran College, she's with us in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
This concert on Saturday is being billed as a homecoming concert
uh-huh.
for you for obvious reasons. So I was hoping you might look back at how your connection with the violin developed for you as you grew up here. When did it start for you?
I started playing violin when I was 3 years old. I was trained in the Suzuki Pedagogy Program, which is the system where you start as a really young child, and it's the mother tongue method. So you learn how to play by ear just the same way you learn how to speak your language without learning how to read or write at first. It's the same kind of idea. My family was living in Arkansas at the time when I started the Suzuki program. I was three. I have two older sisters who also did the Suzuki program and a younger sister who did it. My parents were your typical Suzuki parent. They were completely involved 100% in our training. When I was eight, my dad became a professor at Wisconsin Lutheran College. He's a musicology professor there. And we moved up here, and they scoped for Suzuki teachers in the area, and their search led to Mrs. Fitzgerald, Celestine Fitzgerald, who teaches with the Barcel Academy. And I took lessons for her from the age of eight until I was about 16. And the Barcel Academy is celebrating their 20th year this year, and I was actually there when it first started, and I learned from Mrs. Fitzgerald and her daughter Colleen also while I was a member there. So it's been this – I went through all of the books. I went to Suzuki Institute. I'm here to help celebrate Barcel's achievements over the past 20 years. It's amazing, and also just to revisit – my family obviously is good to see because I don't get to Milwaukee very often.
Well, and you mentioned that your parents were typical Suzuki parents.
Yes, yes.
And that is something that even if people understand the Suzuki philosophy, maybe they don't grasp about the parental and family involvement in Suzuki. Why is that such a big part of the equation?
Dr. Suzuki, when he created his system, he was really looking for something that would involve an entire community, something that would make a whole community really learn something beautiful. And his whole philosophy is to create beautiful people by teaching them music. And I think the parental involvement, the way I see it, is really key because when a child sees that their parents are also as involved as the child is supposed to be involved, then it just takes the learning to a whole new level. And it is really a family experience. I mean, for me, it was a complete family experience. My parents, when they first started as Suzuki parents, it's when my older sister was three. So this was 1976. And they were also taking violin lessons with her. I think that's the most rigid structure of Suzuki training. I don't think parents do that as much anymore. And by the time I was around, they weren't really doing that either. But it really, for my sister, it really showed that the parents, you know, they're doing the same thing. It's not just you should go practice. It's actually a whole involvement. Everyone is involved in creating this beautiful person, in creating beautiful music, in creating an atmosphere that really just creates beauty, I think.
Do you feel within that world, were you predestined to be a violin player?
No. It really wasn't something that I knew that I wanted to do for 100% as a career until I was about 16 or 17 years old. And again, I have three sisters, and two of us are professional musicians, and two of us aren't. And the Suzuki philosophy, again, is not to create professional musicians. It's really to create a beautiful human, a beautiful soul, I think Dr. Suzuki calls it. It wasn't – and my parents were never like, this is what you're going to do as a career. They weren't stage parents in that way. They just saw it as something that we would always be able to use and have and say that we did. And it's a great thing. Nobody looks back and says, I wish I didn't know how to play the violin. And my sisters who don't still play professionally, they took lessons for 15 years. So they still are able to play at a very high level, and they're still able to enjoy it completely, even though they don't do it professionally. They still love it.
Do you remember coming to that realization when you were 16 that this might be more than just something you do?
Yeah. I was at the Boston University Tanglewood Institute, which is a summer program for high school students in Lenox, Massachusetts, which is where the Boston Symphony Orchestra's home is. And I had a teacher there who she was just so inspiring. Her name's Bela Kies, and she's still a teacher at Boston University, which is where I got my doctorate. She was incredibly inspiring and just made me realize that this could be the life that I want. That it doesn't make very much money, but I'm really happy doing what I'm doing. I have a flexible schedule. I'm able to create what I love doing all the time, every day. And I love to teach. It's really nice to be able to give that to the next generation.
So. Well, and if I'm not mistaken, you are currently the co-concertmaster and a soloist for the Orchestra of Emmanuel Music,
yeah,
which is based in Boston. Tell us more about that group.
Emmanuel Music, it was founded in 1970 by Craig Smith. He was 23 years old at the time, and he just had a bunch of friends from New England Conservatory, and they said, why don't we do a Bach cantata? And a Bach cantata is it's a musical form where there's usually an opening chorus, so there's a lot of choir members, and then there are arias, so there's soloists in between, and then at the very end there's a chorale, one of the Lutheran chorales. There's over 300 of them, and Craig Smith decided, you know, why don't we just do this the way that Bach used to do it, which means bridging the sermon or right after the sermon in the church service. This started in 1970. It's still going on over 40 years later.
The orchestra has branched out from just Bach, right?
Branched out from just Bach. So actually, we were at Tanglewood this past summer we're doing a piece by John Harbison, who's a very famous American composer. We did his grand opera, The Great Gatsby. It was a real Gatsby year. He wrote this opera in the 90s, but Emmanuel took it on the road, and we performed it at Tanglewood and also at Jordan Hall in Boston. It's a real community of musicians. The people that are there, we see each other every week. So it's not a typical freelance job where you just see each other when you're hired and you're just gone. You actually see the same people return week after week. So it becomes a real community environment. And I was also fortunate. I did my concerto debut with them in September. I was a soloist for Beethoven Triple, the violin soloist for Beethoven Triple, at the end of September. And that was a real treat, a real experience. It was really fascinating and very exciting for me.
And you mentioned freelancing. Mm-hmm. As we look at your biography, it seems to speak to a reality of being a classical musician today, and maybe always. I mean, you're also a member of the, if I'm saying it right, Arnais Quartet.
Arnais Quartet, yeah.
You perform with a chamber group in Vermont sometimes. Mm-hmm. You teach privately and through a public schools extension program. How do you balance all those roles?
My life is a pretty typical Bostonian musician life. I'm very lucky to live in Boston. They have a very thriving freelance scene. I'm part of the Boston Musicians Union, the American Federation of Musicians, and that provides a certain scale for us to get paid so that we can survive on a freelance salary. There's so many good musicians in Boston. So everyone usually has a teaching job at some point. The teaching is the regular, the steady, you know what's going to happen. You can, and then you schedule around that. So my typical week is in the mornings I have quartet rehearsal. In the afternoon I teach my students, and in the evening I have rehearsals for my freelancing job. It's busy, and I never really actually have a whole day off. There's always something going on every single day. But at the same time, what is nice is that it is my schedule, and I am able to have the flexibility to do all of the things that I do want to do. The quartet is something I've been doing for about 4 years, and if I wasn't a freelancer, I don't think we would have been able to do what we have done in the past 4 years. We've traveled to China. We went to Italy. We've done a lot of competitions. We've played a lot of concerts in California. It just kind of took off in a way that we didn't really expect, and it's been fantastic.
Is marketing yourself part of the equation as well?
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about your background, and it sounds a lot. You know, we do plenty of interviews with indie musicians,
right.
singer-songwriter types, and it sounds a lot like the classical version of that.
You do have to market yourself. And actually, I did my undergrad at Eastman, and I graduated in 2006. And I think they were just – at Eastman, they were just starting to present classes that people could take about how to market yourself, how to be an entrepreneur as a musician. This is something that is becoming more and more important. You can be your own agent, essentially. And that's kind of what the quartet has done, the quartet that I'm a member of. We do everything ourselves. We do all of our own marketing. We do all of our own PR, everything that we need to do in order to promote ourselves, to advertise. We are able to do now on our own because there are all these tools for us to do that. But it is something that musicians need to know how to do more and more. I never took that class at Eastman. I probably should have.
There is not a Suzuki school for marketing.
No, not as far as I know. I haven't learned about that yet.
You know, we've been hearing, and I'm sure you've heard this, that classical music is a dying genre. We've heard this for decades, maybe,
right.
Maybe even centuries. Obviously, that hasn't happened. You were attracted to it. And there are obviously, since you're able to successfully teach, there are obviously younger people who are attracted to it. Do you see in your students the same kinds of things that attracted you to this world?
I do. One of the things that really immediately attracted it for me was orchestra. I was part of the Milwaukee Youth Symphony Orchestra while I was here for 8 years. And I kept going back to orchestra because I loved the feeling of playing with all of, you know, we're all creating this sound together. We're all working together to create the sound. And with my students now, I have a lot of students where I know that they wouldn't be taking lessons anymore if they didn't love orchestra so much, or chamber music, or playing with others. That, you know, playing with your friends, working on something, and students, they're very smart. They can see the progress. They see day one how terrible it sounds, and it's just so hard. But then by the time they get to the concert, they're so happy. And that kind of euphoria of working on something that hard, I think that they really sense it and they really see it. And it becomes – I mean, I became addicted to that great – you know, I work really hard and then I get this product. And it just really became amazing. And for Suzuki, as a Suzuki kid, when I was part of the Barcel Academy, playing in group class, gave me that same kind of feeling. You know, we rehearsed every Sunday night and we worked together, and there were only about 8 or 9 of us at the beginning, and, you know, but we became really good friends, and then playing music together just really cemented those, you know, such a great feeling of self-worth and that we're doing something special. And I don't think that people wanting to become classical musicians will ever go away, because it is such an amazing feeling. And the music that we prepare, it's the best. It's such amazing music to play and to perform. And, you know, freelance musicians, I recently read some letters by that Haydn had written after he spent some time, you know, he was a pensioned, you know, he was a kept man at the estate at Esterhazy when he spent most of his life there. And he had a regular salary. He had, you know, what we consider a 9-to-5 job kind of idea, where he knew exactly where his next paycheck was coming from. And then after he was allowed to go, and he was in London, and in London, he was working as a freelancer. And he wrote this letter that, oh, the freelance life is, I get to make my own schedule, but I'm a little bit worried. I don't know where my next paycheck is coming from. So it's a balance. You have to see it as a balance for that. And as far as the classical music, you know, dying, I think that my generation is coming up with 100 new ways of advocating for classical music and advertising it in a very appealing way. One of the things my quartet does in Boston, we play for a group called Opus Affair, and there's a guy, Graham Wright, in Boston, has created, it's kind of a social scene where he rents out a space and people are allowed to enjoy a beverage, enjoy drink or food or whatever while they're listening to a classical music concert. It's not background music, but it's a much more relaxed atmosphere. It's attracting a lot of attention in the arts community in Boston that he's, you know, bringing together all different ages of people, not only who are in the arts, but also who love to go to concerts.
It sounds entirely energizing.
It's very energizing, actually. It sounds great. Yeah.
Well, Heather Braun, thank you so much for sharing this world with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Violinist Heather Braun grew up in Wauwatosa. She holds her Doctor of Musical Arts degree from Boston University and is co-concertmaster of the Orchestra of Emmanuel Music in Boston. She's back in Milwaukee to play a concert in honor of her other alma mater, Barcel Suzuki String Academy. You can hear her talk about the Saturday evening program in the supplemental audio section of WUWM.com/Lake Effect. That's where you can also hear the full piece that she's playing us out with, the first adagio movement of the Bach Solo Violin Sonata in G minor. That is all for Friday's edition of Lake Effect. We're produced by Bonnie North, Stephanie Lecce, and Dan Harmon, with production assistance from Eleanor Peterson and Nathan Royster. I'm Mitch Tyke. Keep the umbrella handy. Looks like it'll be a wet weekend, perfect for tuning in for Lake Effect Weekend tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.